WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. One expert thinks he knows what caused last month's smelly water in Orange County. The Furious Flower Conference that convenes every 10 years in Harrisonburg kicks off its fourth gathering. And a JMU political expert discusses the threats to Virginia's voting system. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, September 19th. Taste and odor expert may have determined the cause of last month's foul-smelling water in Orange County. Patrick Larson with VPM News has this update.
The petroleum-like odor was first reported on August 21st by residents in eastern Orange County. A submerged water pump experienced, quote, catastrophic failure on August 20th at Wilderness Water Treatment Plant, releasing mineral oil. A representative for Rapidan Service Authority told VPM News a cause was still being investigated, but that the pump was less than 2 years old. The pump distributor told the Virginia Department of Health that the failure was likely due to electrical issues. The pump was higher horsepower than its predecessor, but the electrical system wasn't updated to reflect that. Components of mineral oils were discovered in water samples from the event earlier this month, and now a taste and odor expert has matched those samples to oil used in the pumps. RSA says it stopped receiving calls about the odor early this month. A do not drink advisory was lifted August 27th.
Patrick Larson reporting. The Virginia Department of Education's guidelines for the treatment of transgender students in public school can remain in place. Two lawsuits filed earlier this year to strike down the policies have been dismissed for procedural reasons. Also with VPM News, Whitney Evans reports.
The ACLU filed the complaints in York and Hanover counties earlier this year on behalf of two transgender students it says were harmed by the Education Department's policies. The complaints argue the policies don't comply with the 2020 state law, which directed the department to develop guidance based on evidence and scientific research. The policies issued last summer align with Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's focus on keeping parents informed about their children's lives rather than protecting student privacy. Attorneys for the department successfully argued state law shields the agency from being sued. The courts also found the ACLU missed an administrative deadline.
Whitney Evans reporting. A conference that convenes every 10 years in Harrisonburg to honor and study Black poetry kicked off its fourth gathering this week. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
Hundreds of poets from around the world will assemble at James Madison University this week to learn from MacArthur Fellows, Pulitzer Prize winners, and poet laureates, including Rita Dove, Terrence Hayes, and Tayimba Jess. The theme of Furious Flower 4, Celebrating the Worlds of Black Poetry, speaks to the multitudes contained within the field.
I say Furious Flower is kind of both the state of the union of Black poetry and the family cookout of Black poetry.
Lauren K. Elaine is the executive director of the Furious Flower Poetry Center. The decennial conference carries on the legacy that Joanne V. Gabbin began in 1994, when Black poets were much rarer to find in curricula or on college faculties. But recognition of these artists has grown.
We are now committed to this tradition of saying, hey, we see us, and we have this rich tradition, and we're going to celebrate this rich tradition. We're going to have conversations about this tradition together. We're going to nurture the next generation of this tradition together. We're going to honor the ancestors and the elders in this tradition together.
The conference includes free poetry readings that are open to the public and a ticketed finale concert at the Forbes Center with country singer-songwriter Brittany Spencer. And if you want to tune in from home, a podcast launches this week featuring conversations with Furious Flower Award winners. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
You can find links to more information at WMRA.org. Full disclosure, WMRA's operating license is held by JMU's Board of Visitors. Virginia's lengthy early voting period starts tomorrow. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has this preview.
Virginia has 45 days of early voting, which is one of the longest in the country. Senator Aaron Rouse is chairman of the committee that oversees voting laws in Virginia, and he says Democrats will continue to reject Republican efforts to roll back early voting.
It's very hypocritical for Republicans to bring bills for the General Assembly and actually sign on bills that would restrict the number of early voting days, but didn't yet turn around and try to get their constituency to vote early.
Many of the bills trying to roll back early voting are presented as getting rid of pandemic-era changes to voting rules. But Delegate Sia Price is chairwoman of the House Privileges and Elections Committee, and she says the General Assembly approved of new voting rules like the 45 days of early voting before the pandemic.
Some of the barriers that we got rid of and some of the changes that we made come out of the Jim Crow era. And so this was not a pandemic-focused response. This was a democracy-focused and voter-focused response, many of these proposals that we got passed.
She says she plans to vote as part of Souls to the Polls Sunday voting, which is available in some parts of Virginia. Michael Pope.
Yesterday, I spoke with Valerie Solfaro, political science professor at James Madison University, about some of the choices on our ballots as voters start heading to the polls tomorrow. I also asked her to reflect on increasing threats, particularly from the right, on the security of our elections process and the challenges facing election officials.
I think that they're facing a variety of challenges. I mean, first of all, as always, we have an influx of new voters, and now that we've moved to early voting, right, they're having to prepare for elections earlier. There's also the potential problem of election observers challenging people who want to vote, right? And that's a problem that a lot of states are facing. Other potential threats are the same kind of threats that schools face, right? I mean, I worry about election day bomb threats.
Wow. Okay.
And so I don't know if we'll have more of a law enforcement presence at election time than we used to. But because some voters and some political partisans are concerned about people who aren't citizens voting, right, they're concerned about outright fraud at the polls, they're concerned about fraud in ballot counts, there's going to be a lot more oversight and there's going to be a lot more controversy over outcomes and the process, right, when in reality, our elections are pretty stringently monitored. The idea of cheating conceptually might make sense, but logistically it's very difficult. So in terms of the security of our elections, most political science studies show that we don't really have a problem with people not voting. In fact, our problem is actually with people not voting enough. So there are public opinion polls suggesting, for example, that a significant number of Americans think they're not allowed to vote if they owe child support. They're not allowed to vote if they owe back taxes. They're not allowed to vote if they haven't paid their parking fines. And of course, these are people who are eligible to vote, but they're so spooked by the idea that they could be arrested at the polls that they're staying away. So it's more of a problem of people not thinking they're allowed to vote than it really is people taking a great risk and voting when they're not supposed to.
Well, and you mentioned the perceived question about fraud. Mm-hmm. And the claims of fraud these days seem to be coming mostly from the conservative, the Republican side, and particularly from the top, Donald Trump, with all his claims about winning the 2020 election, which
except
he actually lost.
Yeah.
Right. But my understanding is that study after study shows that the problem of fraud, to the extent it exists, is vanishingly small.
It's vanishingly
not a problem.
There's not much of an incentive. And think about what you would have to do in order to commit fraud, especially with the mail-in ballot. So there's a signature match, which means you have to get someone's signature, and it has to be credible enough to match a machine. And most of us don't have access to someone else's signature. I mean, no one writes checks anymore. And you're not like giving your driver's license away. So the people who have access to your signature are usually the people in your own house, which is what has actually happened, right? As the few instances of fraud that we've seen have been people voting for their own relative. It's not strangers submitting a bunch of ballots. And quite a few of those were actually submitted by Republicans, not because Republicans are more likely to cheat, but because Republicans were more likely to think Democrats were cheating, right? And thus feel like their actions were justified. And so telling Americans that people are cheating might actually perversely have the effect of making people think that they can test the limits. The penalties seem to be pretty strict, though. And again, most people who are not here legally or who are not citizens tend to be fairly law-abiding. They tend to commit fewer crimes than other Americans. And so the likelihood of violating a federal law and risking federal prison just hasn't been substantiated. People tend to not want to do that, and there's no evidence that they are. But the fear is real because it affects our willingness to accept election outcomes, right? Our willingness to agree that a candidate has a mandate to lead and to govern. So to the extent that we don't believe our elections are fair, or that we believe someone has cheated, then it affects the credibility of government itself and potentially our willingness to take actions then to undermine that government, right? And that's what January 6th showed us. When people are really convinced an election is unfair, then they might resort to non-democratic means, and we might have a non-democratic transition of power. And so that's what political scientists are worried about. One political scientist famously said that elections are when one party loses, right? So a party has to be able to lose and walk away from an election.
Right.
If a party always wins, obviously it's not a democracy. If you can't accept losing and go and reorganize yourself for another day and another fight and make a more effective appeal to voters, then again, that's a problem for democracy as well.
Valerie Solfaro is professor of political science and political communication coordinator at James Madison University. Valerie, thanks very much for your time and your insights.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
You can hear my full conversation with Valerie, including yesterday's survey of races and candidates in our area, at WMRA.org or on the app. Finally today, Virginia legislators, legislative staff, and political junkies all use the same system to learn about when a new bill drops, gets a hearing, or gets voted on. It's about to get its first major overhaul since its inception 30 years ago. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner has more.
The first thing you'll notice on Virginia's new Legislative Information System, or LIS, is the color. It's been tan and red for years. Now it's blue and white.
You know, we looked at some studies, and it was easiest on the eyes.
That's Dave Burhap, director of the Division of Legislative Automated Systems. He and Diane Seaborn, a manager at DLAS, said the independent agency that supports House, Senate, and other commission work has spent the last 5 years creating the new system after getting the okay from the legislature. Top concerns were security and function improvements, and while LIS had some superficial improvements over the years, it's basically stayed the same since it was first introduced in 1994. Seaborn was around back then, and she said tracking bills before LIS was a nightmare.
Manual processes, very, very late nights, just matrix printers, you know, it was crazy.
The new system is considered a major overhaul. Much of the improvements make things easier for clerks and legislative staff to help move things through the process. But there's improvements for users, too. A more robust and visible search bar, a calendar feed on the homepage, and more watch lists that can hold more bills. Still, don't expect too much user shock when you first log in.
We wanted to stick to what the look and feel was of the previous system because a lot of people really, really liked it.
The new LIS launches Monday, September 23rd. Its first real stress test, another issue after years of crashes due to too many users, will likely be before the next legislative session starts in January 2025. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Thursday.